So it's just like, okay, let's just have a real talk, no censorship.
Welcome to another edition of the Boiling Frogs Post Roundtable, a lively, unscripted discussion, and even we don't know where it's going. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco. I host the Peter B. Collins podcast at peterbcollins.com and the Processing Distortion podcast here at Boiling Frogs Post. Joining us from deep in the heart of Texas, Guillermo Jimenez. He is the guy who hosts the podcast called Demanufacturing Consent here at Boiling Frogs, and his own home is tracesofreality.com. Welcome, Guillermo.
Thanks, Peter.
Joining us live from Japan is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com, and the host of the Eye Opener video series here at Boiling Frogs Post. James.
Thanks for having me along for the ride.
And our publisher and major domo, or is that domess, Sibel Edmonds joins us from Bend, Oregon, where she dislocated from the Beltway a couple of years ago and is really enjoying it. She, of course, is the publisher of BoilingFrogsPost.com, the author of Classified Woman, and a forthcoming novel that we are all looking forward to. Sibel?
Hello, everyone.
Now, Sibel, you triggered our topic with a recent post at Boiling Frogs Post that really got my attention, which you titled The American Majority and Its Deadly Chronic Disease Called Apathy. And I am going to claim California as the new home of apathy in the United States, at least temporarily. We held a primary election last week and had a turnout of 29%. And 300,000 people cast a vote for a candidate for Secretary of State, which is arguably one that demands fairly high ethics. They voted for the guy who is being investigated by the FBI and who has been suspended from the state Senate for campaign finance problems, as well as a scheme we're told that involved gun running from the Philippines. Yes, 300,000 Californians voted for the guy who obviously has the biggest ethics problems of any of the people on that part of the ballot. So, Sibel, why don't you establish your case, because you made a good case in your essay that you've seen enough investigations, you've seen enough whistleblowers, and you are very directly taking a look at the American people and saying you're apathetic.
We all have, not only me, and I believe you all agree with this. Up until a few years ago, I was out there together separately, but basically voicing the same opinion as people like Dan Ellsberg, as saying we need more whistleblowers, we need more reports coming out, you know, and more exposés, more leaks, because we need to show the American people what is being done to them, to the rest of the world, on their behalf, under their name. And so I was part of that campaign up until about 2006, 2007. And also with my own experience as well, being a whistleblower, coming out in 2001, 2002, saying that, well, you know, we get these cases and we go to Congress, we get the Congress Act, because if we show these leaks, if we show these documented, these evidence of wrongdoing, then we're going to get the public's outrage, which is going to drive the congressional action. And the courts, of course, always respond to that kind of reaction from people. And we're going to address some of these issues. Now, you may want to call it naive, but I truly believe that. And we've had whistleblowers. We had Abu Ghraib, you know, and we had the NSA disclosure in 2004, 2005. Yes, people, it's 10 years old, the story. The general story is at least 10 years old, that we are being spied upon and our conversations are being monitored. You know, we had all the stuff with the FBI. All these things came out. And Congress had it, people had it, even the mainstream media with their blackout, they had it to a certain degree. Hey, they waited 2 years, but the New York Times published it. Yeah, NSA is spying on you, all of you, period. And what happened? Really, what happened? You always end up having a little bit of tough talk from the Congress initially. When the things break, they say, oh, okay, let's see what people got to do. Let's talk tough and say, these are outrageous. We cannot tolerate things like this. Then they see that the outrage, really, the initial small level of outrage dies and nothing. Nothing. What happened with Abu Ghraib? What happened with all the whistleblower cases? What has happened with NSA cases? So initially, as a whistleblower, as a campaigner out there going lobbying Congress, I was screaming at the media, pointing my finger at them, and I was doing the same with Congress, protesting in front of their offices, the relevant offices, going to courts, pounding at their doors. Since 2007, 2008, I came to this realization both as an activist, but also as a whistleblower, as someone who has gone through the experience, that the biggest culprit is not the courts, it's not the Congress, they are not the biggest. See, that's the distinction I'm making here. The biggest culprit, our biggest enemy as activists, as whistleblowers who have put everything on the line, you know, has been the public apathy. That has been the biggest obstacle for any real meaningful changes that we have been demanding, the irate minority, the few of us, public apathy. And even within those activist communities, people are quick to point finger at the smaller culprits and not really turn the finger at themselves, at us, public, the majority, the people, and say, we are the reason. And if we don't do that, you can have more leaks. In fact, they're becoming desensitized, both the public and the government. Oh, yeah, let's see what's going to happen with this one. Good, because the next one is going to make less weight because people are getting used to it. And that's what I call our biggest enemy today, our biggest obstacle, and that is the apathy.
Now, Sibel, we are violating one of the fundamental rules of media by blaming our viewers and readers and criticizing them. Because at least in the tradition in the United States, we only pander to our followers. And we are always very careful, you know, to massage their egos and to acknowledge their intelligence. And let me stipulate that we don't for a moment doubt the intelligence of anyone who is viewing this video podcast. But we have to look at the big picture that, as you point out, all of this information has been available, some of it for more than 10 years. And we've seen that while there was a shift in the White House, the protest movements actually have died down under Obama because most of them were left of center. And so we do have a situation here where the public has the information that you just alluded to and appears to have no motivation to really do anything about it. Now, there are many exceptions. We all know people who care deeply, who are passionate about the issues, who want to organize and work for change. But let me pose to James and Guillermo, have we reached a point where there's a combination of brainwashing, where people are led to believe that the latest celebrity diet craze or the latest kidnapped young woman is the most important thing going on, as opposed to, say, the fact that Obama recently completely changed the exit plan from Afghanistan, and I didn't hear any words of criticism from any quarters in this country. It's like, oh, whatever, you know, Afghanistan, whatever. James, you want to go next?
Well, I'll take my first crack at it. Yes, I think that there's the danger in this type of conversation of extrapolating from our own personal experience and personal psychology and then wondering why everyone else isn't quite like that. And I think we have to approach this from a more scientific approach. And there are scientific ways to approach this question of why people basically give up. And I'd point to some research that was conducted at University of Pennsylvania, I believe, in 1967 by Martin Seligman, who did a famous set of experiments. He was in the Skinnerian behavioral conditioning school of thought. And so he was doing conditioning experiments with dogs, including experiments that involved giving dogs electric shocks. So experiments that probably would not be conducted any longer. But at any rate, at that time, what they did was they took three different groups of dogs. The first group were simply restrained in a harness and then let go after a period of time. The second and third groups consisted of paired, yoked pairs of dogs, so that a dog in group two was attached to a dog in group three via an electronic device or what have you, so that they were not only harnessed, but they were actually delivered electric shocks. Now, the dogs in group two could end the shock by pressing a lever. The dogs in group three had a lever, but the lever did nothing. It did not stop the shocks. So for the dogs in group two, the shock came and they could press the lever and end it. So there was a clear sort of connection between their action and the ending of the shock. For the dogs in group three, it seemed completely random to them whether they could stop the shock, when it came, when it ended, so that it was completely out of their control. After the experiment, they discovered that the dogs in group one and two actually recovered quite quickly from the event, but the dogs in group three showed signs of chronic depression. So what they then did was they took these three groups of dogs and they put them all equally into this fenced area with a low barrier around the floor. The floor was electrified so that they could deliver shocks through the floor, but the dogs could quite easily jump over the little barrier that they placed around it and get out of the way of the shocks. The group one and two dogs invariably would jump out of the way of the shock. The group three dogs actually lied down passively and started whining, taking the shocks when they could quite easily avoid them. And that was interesting and quite a startling result, because it went against sort of the tenets of Skinnerian behavioral cognitive models. But perhaps not that surprising for the social engineers, who have known for a very long time, for example, that you can restrain a 10,000-pound adult elephant with a puny little rope, not because the elephant can't break the rope, but because they have been trained since birth with heavy chains, tying them up since the time they were very small, that they can't break free of their harness, so that when they actually get big enough that they could quite easily do it, they don't even try to do it. This is, again, a very, very common thing among many different species, and of course, humans fundamentally no different. We can be trained into what this is called learned helplessness, and we can be trained into that by simply being in situations where nothing we do seems to actually affect anything. We have a lever, but it does absolutely nothing. And I think that's a perfect model for what happens in our representative democracies, where basically we have the lever of the voting booth, and it does absolutely nothing. You can vote for Team Bush or Team Obama, and the same drone killings, unconstitutional wiretapping, and all of this continues to go on, and people arrive at that point of learned helplessness. Nothing they do can make any difference. Now, Martin Seligman actually went on to develop a theory of learned optimism. He basically split humanity into pessimists and optimists, and he developed a test that you can take online to determine whether you are fundamentally optimistic or pessimistic. And he found that the pessimistic were by far the majority, and people who were more likely to be prone to depression. And he linked that with that cognitive model of people who basically feel that whatever happens, it's their fault and there's nothing they can do to get out of it. And so he proposed a model of learned optimism in which he speculated that you can actually train yourself, and provided some research to back this up, you can actually train yourself to become more optimistic and thus more in control of your own actions and the effects that they cause. And basically this was an ABC model of cognitive understanding of adverse events, adversity, belief, and consequence. So and the example on Wikipedia, if someone cuts you off in traffic, that's the adversity. The belief is, oh, what an idiot, he's so selfish, he's so rude. The consequence, you become angry and you start yelling profanities at the other driver, which is an experience I'm sure we can all relate to, me personally as well. But he proposes to add a couple of extra letters to that ABC model. D, disputation, where you start questioning your negative beliefs about that and what caused it and what you can do about it. And then E, energization, which means that you can actually then positively overcome that situation by basically becoming conscious of your own reactions and trying to work around them. Now, there's debate about his own learned optimism model, but I think at any rate it provides us some context to this that I think puts it in a very clear way that this is not something that's only an American phenomenon or even a human phenomenon, but I think a phenomenon that transcends species, and it relates not just to brainwashing. It's not just brainwashing, although of course there's the media social conditioning element to it, but I think it's a cultural milieu. It's an entire context, an interlocking web of social and political institutions that make it so that it seems that nothing we do actually matters. And when we are subjected to that for long enough, we basically give up, and we have to relearn how to process that information and then how to basically overcome it. And again, we can talk about how to do that, but I think that's the framework that I would put this in.
All right. Guillermo, what would you like to open with? That was very interesting.
Well, I should have gone first because there's really no way I can follow that, James. Thanks. But no, and honestly, the learned helplessness was actually what I was going to go with as well, because when listening to Peter and Sabelle open this up, I started thinking, and that's something that I when I start, you know, sort of tackling the issue in my own mind, I personally have to try and balance my pessimism with my realism, right? Because I don't want to project that image of that everything is hopeless. Because oftentimes if we start talking about apathy and how things are so messed up, you know, and you should care about it, you can sometimes project to your audience, the people out there listening, that things are so bad that nothing can be done about it. And that's obviously a problem that feeds into this whole apathy sort of cycle. But there's a lot to be said for that, James. I think that's a good point. I mean, it takes a great deal of effort and time to be informed, to know the issues, to know, you know, where everyone stands on this, that, or the other thing. And what do you get out of it? You know, what does the average person get from putting that amount of effort into following the news and things like that? So I've mentioned this before. There's a cost benefit analysis that any rational person might make, and it might lead you to, you know, one direction rather than the other. But I guess in that regard, what I would like to do, and what I try to do anyway, is try to appeal to people's self-interest in a way, because ultimately I think that might help to pull them out of that apathy. Because, you know, something Sabelle said earlier as we were opening this up had me thinking, which I slightly disagree with, only slightly, because I think we all generally agree that apathy is a problem. But something you said about the idea that we've had enough revelations, that, you know, no amount of and no new whistleblower, no new information is going to help unless we break out of that apathetic shell, which I agree with to some extent. But I would say, me personally, I do want, and I think we'd all agree on this, I do want more information. I do want to see more whistleblowers. I do want to see more data and more information, because I personally am interested in what my government is doing in my name and what's happening, and I have a self-interest involved here. I need to know. I have a my own personal need to know and need to share it. So I think if in some way we can tap into that and have people understand that they individually are affected by what's happening and should care for their own self-interest. I mean, I hate to put it break it down to just that, but I think that might help at least in some way to bust out of that apathetic shell a little bit.
Well, let me add to the concepts that have been brought up here, and in particular the learned helplessness, a couple of layers. One is the palpable fear that has been pumped into our culture, most notably since 9/11, but it certainly occurred before then. And just when you go to the airport, it's the theater that is there to remind you of government control, of the intrusive nature of the national security state. And I do think that it has an impact. The other is the psychic burden of perpetual war. Because I'm a fundamentally optimistic person. I wake up every morning thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to take on the day. And, you know, then I do my rituals and read the newspapers and get caught up on what's happened in the preceding 8 to 10 hours. And realism sets in. And with the realism comes a heavy dose of cynicism. And those emotions, those attitudes, and those filters are all influenced by these additional factors, the perpetual war and the injection of a government-sponsored fear. Sabelle?
No, I go through that every day just like you do. And one more comments on Guillermo, what you said. Absolutely, I'm like you. I need more information. I want to know. But again, what I'm seeing is that happens to be the irate minority. That's why I keep using that, because it's us. With many people, you put it in front of them. I do it. I show it, and I try to be very nice. I kind of smile and say, "Well, have you seen this? You know, have you like the Common Core? I made a few copies of that, and I took it to the parents of my daughter's classmates. You know, for pre-kindergarten, and I'm like, have you seen this information? Have you looked into Common Core and the issues? Because now it's going to be implemented here in Oregon as well." And they want to avoid it. "Oh yeah, I think it's a good thing." I said, "Why do you say that?" And they say, "Well, because we have really, really, really gone down, and we need to get back and be competitive with the rest of the world, and we gotta get tougher with our education system." I said, "But have you really looked into the different research papers done that says it doesn't really do that in terms of bettering them, in terms of education and really bringing them up?" I don't know. I just don't want to look at it. I don't want to see it. I don't want to even take that CD, take 10 minutes and watch it. There is this resistance. They don't want to even look at it. Now, if it were about some puppy somewhere, the one that example that I was giving you, they would be all over it. I want to see that cute puppy. Hopefully he will get rescued. So that's why I'm saying is for us, the irate minority, it goes to the same pool of all the knowledge, information we use, we process, we are trying to figure out ways to get out of this. And then the other thing with Peter, one of the things that is amazing to me, and that also goes to James, you made great points there. And the difference is, I'm seeing, let's say I grew up in countries like Turkey, Azerbaijan, Iran, and let me give an example of Turkey. Talk about fear. I mean, they have been tortured to death, okay? A lot of activists there, people disappearing, you know, the number of reporters who are jailed. So I'm talking about overt police state rather than even more effective covert police state we have here. How come it doesn't affect them that way? And they have been going from one crap to another crap, you know, military coup that happened, and from that they had all these charlatans, and they each got billions of dollars, more people disappeared. Yet, tens and 20 and 30 and 40 years later, they're going out there and they are so driven, passionate, and I'm not saying most of it may be not misplaced or some of them are being taken advantage of. I'm not talking about the purposes, but the fact that they haven't become desensitized and they haven't become helpless despite all the torture, despite all the ferocious acts, applied to them every day for all those years. I was talking to this one lady friend, and she said during these big Gezi protests in Taksim and the area near there and other areas, even people who did not participate in protests, this is during the nighttime, the tear gas are being, dumped on people. All the houses on all the streets, like I would say 99% of the houses, they left their doors open, the apartment buildings. So when people were running from the police and everything, every door in every street would be open. They could go in there when they're chased, close, and just take refuge there so they won't get arrested. Not one or two. So even people who didn't protest, they were joining in there, the solidarity there, and saying, "This is the way I'm gonna help." So these poor guys, when they are running away, they can come, they can shut the door, and the police won't find them because they're not gonna break into these apartments. What's the difference there, James? I mean, you learn helplessness. I have dealt with it a lot. I have dealt with it with abused children. I represented sexually abused children, battered women. I taught courses in, women abuse, the spousal abuse, and I have seen a lot of learned helplessness. And in what example you provided, I see exactly that a lot. But why does it work a certain way here versus not in this way, maybe in different way or to a lesser degree in other countries that they have much worse police state in terms of overt police state practices?
Well, there's, I think, a couple of different points to sort out there. One is that, for example, in the example that you provide, you have the example of a domino effect of people standing up, encouraging other people to stand up. I think when people see that example, then they have an example that it becomes easier to follow. And in fact, there's a brilliant video up on YouTube. I'll put it in the show notes. I can't remember the title off the top of my head, but it's talking about how groups are formed or how a movement starts. Mm. And it's, it actually shows some guy dancing in a weird way at a festival. And he's just dancing out there doing his own thing, looking crazy. And then after a little while, someone else joins in and is kind of like mocking the guy, but he's still kind of doing the dance. And after that, you get a few more people coming, and then at the end of the video, you have like 100 people getting up and all joining in this crazy dance. And the point of that video was to say it isn't even the first person who does it. I mean, he's just the one who starts it, but the one who really gets the movement going is the second person, the one who follows the person who's leading, because then other people have the example of how to follow. So I think that there is a domino effect that happens in certain circumstances, and we can see that. I mean, that's one of the phenomena surrounding something like the Arab Spring. Obviously, there was a lot of outside intervention and sure. other things going on there. But one of the things around that is that people are seeing these things happening and dictators being overthrown, only to be reinstalled in Egypt and things like that. But at any rate, people get the sense that something's happening, so they pile in and join on. In America, we don't really have that at this stage. But I think also more than that, I think you're right, there is more of a difference than that. And I think it goes down to, it has to, again, quite clearly, it's not the DNA, it's not the genetics, it's not anything like that. It clearly is part of the cultural, social, political milieu of the United States and its affiliated countries, its allied countries, specifically. And why? What is that? What is the defining characteristic about America that America even celebrates about itself? And for that, I would turn to a quote from Noam Chomsky, who, yes, of course, I deride as an establishment gatekeeper, but he has to be a gatekeeper by providing 90% good info so that the 10% can be very bad. And here's an example where I think he hits it right on the head, where he said, all over the place, from popular culture to the propaganda system, there is constant pressure to make people feel that they are helpless, that the only role that they can have is to ratify decisions and to consume. And I think that is very much the key point in when we're looking specifically at the American or the Western context. Consumerism is not just a bad thing because it teaches us just to mindlessly consume crap products that we don't need, although, of course, that is, I think, one of the aspects of it. But it also teaches us the role of being consumers, being passive recipients of whatever. It relates to so many different situations, but the idea, the image, is that we have a shelf of goods and we can choose this brand or this brand, but don't even think about trying to go outside of that box. Don't think about trying to do something yourself. And that is fundamentally the mode that we're in through so many different parts of the political and social and cultural context. And look at the representative democracy idea again. You've got brand X over here that has rat feces and rat poison, but look, brand Y only has rat poison. Hey, I'm going with the poison. That sounds great. What, you don't want the poison? You're crazy. That's the fundamental mindset that people have been placed into, again, for periods of generations. And I think that it's really coming to a head at this point where we really are seeing the extent to which people can be made to be passive. And so look at this in the context, for example, I think what sparked, or at least was the central piece of your piece on this subject, the apathy piece that we're talking about the Snowden revelations. Absolutely. I think it's the same kind of phenomenon going on here, because what is the one thing about all of this that none of the, whatever, Greenwald or Gelman or any of these people are writing about? It's what you actually can do about this. It's not, let's leave it to Congress, so reform. Oh, they're going to put in, you know, the Freedom Act or whatever they're calling it, whatever ridiculous piece of legislation that's actually going to be worse than what we already have. But what can you actually do about it? And there are things you can actually do about it, one of which is to cast your mind back 15 years ago. This is not a long period of time. Cast your mind back 15 years ago. Were you wedded to some sort of mobile device? Were you wedded to email so that you needed to use it constantly? We can still choose to reject this technology to a large extent. We do not need it in our lives. At the very least, we can start actually leaving our cell phone at home when we go outside every now and then. This is something that is never put forward by these people who want you to continue using the technology, but just petition the government to try to make it better somehow. So there's that. And then the other aspect I would say is we can still take this into our own hands by actually making free and open open source software that actually does, we can actually establish the infrastructure to make this a system that it does not have to rely on the telecoms and the NSA and all of that crap that they're trying to inject us into. And these things already exist. Why do people not know about the Open Garden app right now that means that you can have wireless mesh networking with 5 million other people right now just by downloading it as an app that completely goes around the internet? You don't need the internet. It's a wireless mesh network. Why do we not know about the Kansas City Freedom Network and I believe in Oklahoma there's a similar network or in Germany? I covered it recently on my program. A bunch of German villagers got together and decided to create their own broadband network because the telecoms weren't going to do it for them. Why are these examples never put forward to us? And I think if there's anything that we collectively as the alternative media can do, it is to highlight and stress and drive home these examples of what people actually can do to bring it back into their own hands rather than being mindless consumers of information and waiting for some politician to try to deliver it to us.
Two quick comments on the many things you said there, James. Back to the dancer and the people who followed him or her. I take it you've never been to a Grateful Dead concert.
Nope.
Okay. I thought that was true. The other thing is I would just take what you said and reshape it to this point, that Americans have become comfortable accepting false choices that are presented to them. And so you described that very well, depicted it well in the rat poison example. But this is where Americans think inside the box and for whatever reasons decide to stay there. And one of the things that I often pursue is trying to blow up the false choices that are offered to show that there's a range of possibilities that are not even being presented to people for contemplation, much less action. Guillermo?
No, yeah, just quick points. I mean, I think you guys really hit it on the head. Generational conditioning and consumerism. I think that's really is the key. And then you add to that the fact that many of I don't know what you want to call them, gatekeepers or the narrative drivers, whatever you want to call these people that are shaping the media cycle and shaping public narratives regarding specifically the Snowden stuff and all the leaks. They don't question, as you say, James, they don't question the system itself. They stop just short of that. Not only do they not offer any sort of solutions or examples of alternatives, they don't even bother to question the very system itself. I've repeated this quote several different times, so I won't read the whole thing all over again. But Snowden himself has said repeatedly, I love my country. I believe spying serves a vital purpose and must continue. And Greenwald, Gelman, et cetera, have echoed this sentiment and have, in many ways, I feel, reinforced the very system that they're supposed to be fighting against by leaking this information. So there's that. Excuse me. Frog in my throat. No pun intended. Okay. Something else you mentioned, though. I wanted to go back to the question about why in certain places. This is a question that I've always had. I always try to pose to my guests on my podcast, especially if they live in other parts of the world or from other parts in the world, of why it is that in Turkey, as you said, Sibel, or in Brazil, for example, is what's going on right now in response to the FIFA World Cup. Why is it that in certain parts of the world, people are quicker to respond, to rise up, to raise their collective voices, to express their dissent, to shake that apathy and get out into the streets and try to do something. And I think I think that's it. I think it's generational conditioning. I think it's consumerism. It has to be partly economic, right? It's that level of comfort. It's that, Peter, you said that Americans have become comfortable with false choices, and I would completely agree with that. I thought you were going to stop at just comfortable, because I think that's really the key. I think Americans are just too comfortable, period.
And I think that's a very good point, because, again, I had this mini discussion session. I can't find many people around me. That's why you guys are my, my family and friends and all my socializations, basically, among our irate minority members. But we were having this discussion, and I was giving the examples of Turkey and Iran. And And what's interesting is when I get into these discussions, I have lived in the United States for 26 years. I lived in Turkey for about 9 years and in Iran for another 8 years. So the total of the two doesn't even equal how long I have lived here in the United States since the age 17. One of the things they first do is right away at that point, you are not an American and you come from that background. So you don't understand really our culture and how we think. Okay, so I'm still a foreigner, you know, how they refer in some parts of this country. So it's goddamn foreigners. I'm one of those to them. But the second thing is another thing. And again, I think it's ignorance. One of the guy, and this was only 4 nights ago, we were sitting there and talking, and he said, and the big difference is, you know, the people who are doing or engaging those protests in Turkey and Iran, they don't have comfortable life. They have nothing to lose. You know, these people are so poor and religious and uneducated and they don't have job prospects. So their life is like, you know, fine, I'm going to protest. I really, really, really am offended with that line of thinking. I can tell you this, I was about 8 years old, 8 or 9 years old. There was this big black day in Iran called Black Friday, if you're familiar with that infamous day. This was against Shah regime. There was a huge protest with all the university students and professors and the doctors. And not only that, my father, as a very well-known surgeon, okay, who had a lot to lose always, you know, he had a nice house and he had 3 kids and he had a wife and he had 2 cars, you know, in Iran back then. Not only that, he was one of the organizers and he joined, he took me with him, okay? This was my firsthand experience when they brought in the police with all the batons coming after us, and there were a lot of people who got killed. And if you think my father as a surgeon and with what he had, it's what these people are losers, they have nothing to lose. In America, look, no matter what you say, Sibel, come on, you gotta admit it, woman, life is good, you know? I got the white picket fence, and here's my golden retriever, and there are 2 kids within 1 year, 2 years age difference. My wife has a car, I have a car, so what? We have lots of debt and everything. We have 401k, we are already planning where we're gonna move and we retire and the kids go to college. In fact, I just overheard this lady myself in front of my daughter's pre-K school, and she said she just got into this huge fight with her husband about where their kid, the girl, is going to go to university. He wants her to go to Stanford. She wants her to go somewhere else. The kid is 5, okay? So anyhow, and I'm looking at my husband. I'm like, okay, this is the culture you're talking about. I don't understand, because I don't understand it. I really don't get it, but it's part of the culture maybe here. But there is this notion that in those nations and people like me, we came from those kind, and they don't, because they have nothing to lose, man. Here, life is good. I can watch my TV and my match and have my beer and the picket fence and all the stuff. Life is good. I can go to Walmart when there's sale and fill up, you know, the trunk with the Costco products. And if you look at it, our life worth more because our life is good in general. That's why we don't have reason. That's what he's telling me, to go out there and protest like you guys, you foreigners, you know, how you do it. So, you know, this is one of the things that I face. And what I see here is that people basically say this big middle class thing in the United States is comfortable enough, not uncomfortable enough, for people to say, I really don't have much reason to go out there and do anything because life is good, dude.
Well, I'm sorry you're on to the foreigner thing, Sibel. We try to keep that from our foreigners. But I also think you've touched on something, and I don't believe that most Americans look at, say, Turks and say they have nothing to lose. Some do, but I don't think most do. I do believe that many Americans, particularly since we went through the 2008 Wall Street-induced downturn, are on the edge. And there is this combination of the fear that I referred to earlier with the sense that they could lose their car, their house, the ability to buy cheap clothes at Walmart. And so they have created this kind of push-pull set of forces on Americans where, you know, if you go home and watch Idol and, you know, just pay attention to the in-depth reporting at TMZ, you're not going to get in any trouble. It's okay to have opinions, you know, about the Kardashians. Right now, it's fine to demonize Bo Bergdahl and the prisoner swap without questioning whether Guantanamo ever should have existed, much less whether it's legal to remove five people from there for a swap. And, you know, we have now all of these experts on Afghanistan as it deals with Bergdahl and whether he was a deserter or not, but they're not interested in the big picture of why we went in, why we've stayed there for 12 years, how the exit plan has changed. And so we do have, as you referred to earlier, this curious selective apathy where, you know, people are really worked up about Bo Bergdahl. You know, they want his scalp. And yet they're not willing to look at the people who have manipulated and lied to them in the name of keeping them safe. James?
Well, at the risk of introducing yet another model by which we can understand what's happening, I think obviously there is steam in the system that needs to be let off. So there are pressure valves that allow for that steam to be let off. And we see, you know, the Bergdahl issue or similar ones. The Benghazi issue, another interesting one, because there is a very, very big story there about the CIA and about arms smuggling to the terrorists in Syria that will not ever be touched as part of the Benghazi story. Instead, it will all be about, oh, the Obama administration. And they were trying to lie about, you know, what it was, whether it was Al-Qaeda or not, blah, 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 because it's all part of the war on terror.
If I may, regarding Libya, Daryl Issa will focus on Benghazi, and now we've got this Gowdy guy with a special committee, and not a single one of them will question the wisdom of getting involved in the no-fly zone that led to the Air Force support for the rebels. And, you know, obviously was aimed at overthrowing Gaddafi. None of that will be discussed at all.
Right. And I think what the underlying mechanism behind this that makes it so effective is the fact that people actually don't care about Bergdahl. They actually don't care about Benghazi. They don't care about Libya. They don't care about these issues that become these big issues. They only care about it in the sense of scoring political points for their team. It's been shunted off into left-right divide so that people can be grouped around an issue and they can understand which side they're supposed to take and they can get to the right amount of outrage or apathy or uncaring. So if I'm a Democrat, I could say, oh, who cares about Benghazi? It's a non-issue. If I'm a Republican, I can get so angry about it. It's the war on terror. They're not prosecuting the war on terror hard enough because it's all about that system. And I think that fundamentally that speaks to an even deeper issue that, again, I know we always circle around the same subjects, but we have to go back to them because they are the core subjects, which is, how do we become indoctrinated in that mindset that the differences between us on points of ideology are more important than any potential similarities in our situations or in potential solutions? And I think that, again, that fact that we can't see that even though I disagree with this person on this subject and this subject, I agree on this subject, so we could work together on it. That idea is completely abandoned for this hyper-partisanship. And I think it again goes back to the core question of how we are educated, how we are brought up, how we are taught to interact with other people. And I will once again, I'm doing it a lot lately, but I will once again urge every single person who's watching this who hasn't watched the documentary Children Full of Life to watch it, not only because it's my favorite documentary, but because it provides, I think, an example of what it looks like to be in an education environment that actually puts value on the ways that we interact with other people as human beings and how we can learn to do that. And we can learn to do that. And until you see that other alternative example, I don't think you can really appreciate how much we are atomized in our society to the point where we are put at each other's throats and we tend to see ourselves as ringed around by enemies everywhere, while the real enemies can continue to puppeteer the system and let the pressure off with the steam valves. So I think, again, it goes back to some of these core concepts, like the way we're educated and indoctrinated, and then the question is, well, can adults who have been in this system their entire lives really be snapped out of it? I'd like to think the answer is yet, but yes, but that's a different question, perhaps.
We've all heard the phrase, go ahead and talk amongst yourselves. I think I heard it a little bit earlier today. But I think the plutocrats' phrase is, go ahead and fight among yourselves.
Right.
What you were giving an example about partisanship and people being on each other's throat, that's one of the symptoms of this systematic disease that has spread and a lot of people are inflicted in. But also what I see again, and this is being in this area that is, it considers itself the neighborhood where I live, educated, yuppie, environmentalist. So they're activists in environmental grounds to a certain degrees and all those things, New York Times on Sunday, non-fat latte, soy. And that's when I read it on Sunday while the golden retriever is sitting there. I mean, they all act the same way. It's so interesting, In a lot of movies when I was growing up, they tried to portray communism that way. Everybody dressed the same and they do the same thing, like these factory workers. Well, in this area where I live, it's all these people. And by the way, Peter, about 90% of them are transplant from San Francisco. And this is new for me because I'm from the East Coast and it's a quite cultural difference. Nice people, these people are very nice. They're polite, in a distant way. But they're all like these commie films. They all do the same thing, read the same thing on Sunday, exactly the same time, and all these things. But when you get deeper into it and try to find out what they do from medicating their kids at the age 5, and I see that. I'm talking about people who are supposed to be very educated, to diet fads, exercise fads, to a point of, I think, self-mutilation. That's what I'm going to call it. And that includes even their children. They're mutilating themselves. I mean, this is like destruction from within. I have heard and seen things, but not as one here, one there. That is mind-boggling. There's a group of mothers, they're standing there to pick up their kids, and they're talking about, how every day they do, you're familiar with the concept of anorexia, and then there's bulimia where you throw up. Now I found out here, and it's supposedly made in San Francisco, Peter, they give themselves enema every day. They call it the colon cleansing to prevent weight gain in addition to all the dieting. So the food gets out of their system before it gets absorbed by their in some sick, crazy stuff, man. I mean, it's scary for me. I listen to this and I look at my husband, okay, because he says, well, you have to make the effort to make conversation with these people. So I'm standing there. They're talking about mutilating their colons and all the exercise and everything. And my husband says, still, you have to make an effort and blend in and talk with them. I don't know what to say. So I say something very dumb, like, how often do you wash your hair? I made that a stupid comment. I'm standing there and then they looked at me and said, how often do you wash your hair? Because I don't know how to talk to these people. I really don't. And that's
a local sports team. Yeah.
I hate to break it to you.
As irate minority Boiling Frogs post, for example, this was part of some of the discussions I was having with the majority people. The stuff you put forward is just too harsh. It's too hard. It's like a slap in your face. You guys are coming down on people like hammer, and you won't get anywhere like that. That's why you will not attract those people to come and tune into Boiling Frogs Post. You get the like-minded people because you need to get much softer, kind of caressing kind of a way to do that. Well, I don't know how to do that, and I don't even know if that's the effective way. And this is something that I really want to get your opinions on. Basically, this guy says, you got to look more at Gandhi and Dalai Lama, okay? I said, okay, so what are you saying? Just be more specific. We can all crisscross, apple cross, and sit there, and we can chant. And then say, let's chant together first and start this thing. Maybe it starts there. Well, that is not what I believe is needed, and because maybe there are sites like that out there, and I don't see anything wrong with that, but I don't see going there and making these things milder don't put the dead pictures in Afghanistan, for example, he said, this guy, because that's too hard. That's too harsh on people. And people like to avoid things like that. It's unpleasant, but it's just, you know, it's like a pull, push, whatever reaction that you were talking about. They want to go the other way. They don't want to deal with it. I believe we need more pictures from Afghanistan to personalize it the way they personalize cases of JonBenet Ramsey and those people, by saying, these babies you see here, these mutilated dead babies here, were killed by completely your consent. I don't care what they say. Your consent. You know what? Because you're paying for it by your taxes. You vote for it one way or another. You keep voting everything. Everyone you vote, they are going for this. And you are not doing anything about it. So yes, we the Americans are killing. And they're disagreeing when I'm in this kind of discussion with them. No, Sibel, it's not us. If you were to ask most people, they would say they don't agree with it. I said, yeah, but what they say is, unfortunately, that's what happened. This is the civilian casualties. We are fighting the terror there. It's sad. It's really sad. But please don't show those pictures to me again, because fine, I don't want to look at it. Well, I want to do the opposite. I want to show that picture over and over and over and over again, because that's one of the things we did during the Vietnam War. There were some pictures. Those pictures, those visual things actually help some people, in addition to the self-interest of draft, which I will have you talk about it, Peter, since you were around during the 60s here. But there were protests because of self-interest. Draft was there. Most of the congressional people had nephews and sons there that they were being drafted, so they didn't want them to get killed. Nowadays, it's just the people. 10 years from now, it's going to be drones and robots remote. No reason to oppose war. You know why? Because we are not losing anything in terms of our loved ones or anything, or people who matter in this country. They are either foreigners like me for people, or they are people who go to war. That class, it just doesn't exist, and it's not our problem. So as far as the coming down as hammer, I believe we need to do more. I'm actually encouraging our partners, all of us, to do more. We have to get more graphic. We have to make it more real. But people are saying, you got to get softer and do the, you know, I don't know how to chant, Peter, usually. And be kind. You know, there's need for all kinds. We need those Gandhi kind of passive protests and everything. That's beautiful. That's wonderful. We need hammer-like hitting people in the head. We need those disturbing pictures. We need all those elements. But to say that the way to go about it is to become, you know, kumbaya, well, this is not a kumbaya site. And I don't believe that's what we should be doing. And I want to hear your take. Peter?
Okay, well, a few things from what you just said. First of all, I need to warn you that we're dispatching three more Californians to Bend, Oregon. Some neighbors who've lived down the street for about 6 or 7 years sold their house, and they have a daughter who's in the third grade, and they're moving to Bend, and they are completely gluten-free, I'm sorry to report.
Yeah, that too. I haven't met anyone who's not gluten-free, peanut-free, dairy-free, and vegetarian. Go ahead. Now, I am serious. And all their kids are allergic to gluten. All of a sudden, this phenomenon happens. It's worse than the bubonic plague. My daughter's friends, they are allergic to all four items, every single one of them. And first they said you cannot bring it to school because other kids, all of them are allergic. I don't get it. Go ahead, Peter. Wow.
So then since the Vietnam era, people of my boomer generation have been hoping that there would be another window of activism. We thought it would surface against Reagan in the 1980s. We thought, certainly, after Bush 2 took power, and then all of the events that occurred culminating in the invasion of Iraq, we thought that there would be a resurgence of a really active, informed body of protest in this country. And what we have seen is that since Vietnam, when in my view it was self-interest, and I'll use my own case, I drew the lucky number 4 in the final draft lottery under Nixon. And it was that motivated me to be active in opposing the war, to seek conscientious objector status from the draft board. I wouldn't have taken those steps if I wasn't personally threatened by being drafted and sent to Vietnam. And I believe that that was a critical factor, and that if we had had a draft in 2002, that the response to Bush's decision to invade Iraq would have been much different. So the third thing I'll comment on from what you said is the idea of wanting a kinder, gentler approach. And I think that many people have misplaced ideas about that. But I will say that sometimes the tone, and I'm not picking on any particular article or author, but sometimes the tone of what we do can be off-putting to people who are not up to speed as much as we are on these issues. And maybe it's their cynicism hasn't been developed as far as ours. There are many different factors that play into it. And so I don't completely write off what the person told you, that sometimes the hammer is too intense. And personally, I try to vary it. You know, when I do things that I think are really intense and that require the listener to face up to, for example, I did a graphic episode last week about force feeding at Guantanamo. And I think people need to have a choice to hear that. Not everybody is comfortable with it, and that doesn't mean that they are in denial or that they're in some state of refusal. So I think it does vary, and that some people respond to a more open approach that allows them to reach a conclusion, and other people like to have the conclusion drawn for them. And so I think that there are a variety of ways to approach some of these topics, and that there are different people who are receptive to those different approaches. Guillermo, I think it's time to shake things up.
Sure. I think that's a good point. We've talked about this previously, about, you know, how best we can get the message out, how best to get the truth out. And I think what I personally like about our team here at Bowling Frogs Plus is we all have our own sort of personalities. We all kind of sort of put our own touch on how we decide to do what it is that we do. And I really don't give it a whole lot of thought other than in conversations like this. When I'm just, you know, doing the podcast, or even when I'm just thinking about the issues, it comes out the way it sort of just comes out naturally for me personally. And so, but I guess I see your point that there are going to be people out there that are going to be turned off to the way I present something. People are going to be turned off to the way Sabelle presents something, the way Jane presents something. But we can't, we talked about this again before, we can't please everyone all the time. And I think we just have to be true to the message. It really, regardless of style, regardless of personality, regardless of whatever medium you choose to go and put the message out, as long as that message is not watered down, that's what I personally appreciate and look for. So I think a lot of people out there would probably look at things similarly. But again, you know, everyone has their own sort of opinion on what exactly they're looking for. And I do not doubt that there are plenty of people who go to BFP and think that it's too harsh, or that, you know, that it's too heavy of a hammer, like you said, Sabelle.
Radical.
That's a good one. Okay. I have no doubt that there are people who think that. But again, I mean, yeah, I think we could all do, I suppose, more, like you said, Sabelle, to get the message out a little better, a little more. But again, I don't really think about it a whole lot when I'm. You know, doing what it is that I guess what we do. I wanted to go back to a couple of things that you brought up earlier, though, because there was so much that we talked about. But I wanted to go back to this apathy thing and kind of flip it around if we can. And we sort of touched on it a little bit throughout our conversation. We've talked a lot about the things that people don't care about that they should care about. And it's interesting to think about the things that as we pointed out, the things that people do care about. As you said, people care about these crazy diets, or they care about fashion, or they care about the latest gadget or product, or, you know, sports, whatever it might be, entertainment. And it comes back to what you said, Peter, and what we've talked about also, just self-interest and self-gratification. I think that's also a part of it. So I think we do have to key into that. I think for better or worse, self-interest is what drives many of our decisions and our behaviors. So if we are to sort of hone in on what we could individually or as a collective focus on, it is appealing to people's self-interest and saying, hey, this does affect you, or it will affect you individually, personally, very, very soon. To go back to points that you've raised earlier about war fatigue, or the idea of, you know, if a country like in Iraq or Iran, when they're at war, their people know it, right? They feel it. They experience it firsthand. Whereas in the States, we've been at war for what? I don't know. Ever? Not that we know it, right? Not that we feel it, not that we, you know, experience it, not that we know what that's actually like, at least not for a very, very, very long time. So there's a lot to be said for that also. And just I wanted to kind of pose a question, because it's something that I like to think about also with regard to why we do care about the things that we care about. And we talked about the media earlier, about the way the media sort of engineers these things and tells people what they should care about. And I often wonder if it is that, if they are deliberately telling you what you should care about to distract you from the things that you really should care about, or if they're simply, you know, playing to the market, if they're giving you the collective you, right? If they're giving you what you want, they're giving you what they know you'll pay attention to. They're giving you Justin Bieber and they're giving you Miley Cyrus because they know that that's something that you will click on, that's something that you will tune into. Whereas, you know, things that we would find important, generally people would not tune into. So I guess I would want to hear from each of you about that. You know, to what extent you think it is a sort of deliberate, by design sort of action on the part of the media or social engineers or what have you, and to what extent is it giving people what they want? And again, going back to Sabelle's point in the piece, ultimately it's the consumer. Ultimately, it's the person responsible for what he or she decides to pay attention to or not.
James?
Well, I will have to be running along soon, so perhaps we can start making these our closing remarks. But let me just address, again, going back to my original points about learned helplessness and how that plays into this situation. As we talk about self-interest, or we talk about making things more graphic so that people understand what's happening, etc., and I think those are important things. But I would say this has to go back again to the fact that there are two fundamental cognitive models by which people process adverse and negative information. And these have historically been identified as optimism and pessimism, and it's interesting to me to see how those words have been twisted in our popular culture now, so that optimism means something like pie in the sky, starry-eyed dreamer, and pessimism means realist. And that's the way a lot of people interpret it. And I think that says more about the culture that interprets those terms that way than it does about the terms themselves. But basically, I mean, people can experience the same events, and there will be two types of people. There will be the dogs that lie down, passively start whining, and just accept the shocks, and there will be the ones that jump over the barriers. And as those experiments that Seligman conducted in 1967 showed, it wasn't the dogs themselves, it wasn't something about their genetic makeup, it was about the way they had been conditioned to act. So I think, again, we have to understand that this is happening in society generally right now, and there are things that we can do about it. First of all, on the individual level, everyone who's watching or listening to this conversation can start to make conscious the processes by which they process information, so that they can become aware of their habits or their tendencies towards optimism or pessimism, towards thinking this is a horrible thing that's just happening randomly and there's nothing I can do about it, or this is something that I can take into control and I can do something about it. And again, I think we have to become conscious of that process so that we can start moving towards a cognitive understanding of ways that we can actually do something. And then the other side of it is for us and for the media producers out there, I think the way to present this information is, well, again, there are different methods, and I agree. I think sometimes we have to be very graphic and very upfront and very in your face to get certain parts of the audience to understand it, and other approaches, softer approaches might work. But whatever approach we take, I think we also have to stress that missing element that, again, is deliberately excluded from our media diets these days, which is the ways that we can actually personally affect the things that are happening around us, and to highlight the examples of people who are doing that, people who are actually doing things that can have a positive effect. And it is through that reconditioning process that I hope that we can actually start to make inroads on this. But I'm not under no delusions that this will topple overnight, because again, it's a system, a structure, a societal structure that's been in place for a very long time. And now I don't believe has to be enforced strictly from above. I think that we've internalized it to a large extent. So the process is combating that. And I think the few irate minority are in fact the optimists. The people who are still able to get irate are the people who fundamentally believe there's something that can be done about it. So why aren't we doing something about it? Well, let's show people how to do something about it.
I think that is a very important point, and it's kind of counterintuitive. But the fact that we're here discussing apathy is because we're not completely captured by it. And I would like to just clarify on one point that I don't share quite explicitly Sibel's premise that we don't need any more whistleblowers or disclosures. I do think that Snowden has performed some important functions, mostly in confirming the credibility of whistleblowers who came before him. And I do hope, and this is the anti-apathetic optimist, that we will reach a critical mass where people actually do accept that things have to change and that they have to be a driver of it. And one of the things we've seen Greenwald on his book tour teasing that he is going to name names of people who have been surveilled by the NSA. Well, Sibel and I released this information in our interview with Russ Tice a year ago. And it would be great if Snowden's information confirms that, because then the corporate media might actually cover it. And that could lead to change. Some of this is based on hopes, but it's what keeps me going. Otherwise, I would probably just turn off the microphone and say, it isn't worth fighting anymore. And frankly, I haven't finished fighting.
Well, I certainly would agree that we need more revelations coming, and that are legit and they are done for the right purpose. And as for you can actually have damaging when you have the notion of whistleblowing used and that title used, and when people consider something real revelation, you can actually get much more damage than good out of that. And so far, what I have seen based on what I'm looking at, it has been mostly damage. And even with the names, you're right. We had that interview with Russ Tice, but I wonder how much of that is going to depend on the elections coming here in October and November, those naming Congress, and just the fact that from what we have seen, you know, even with Greenwald returning here and all the stuff, the system, CIA loves it. The government loves everything that is coming out. The government has not done a single thing, single action to prevent this. And the media, you said hopefully the media will cover. Not only that, the media has covered all these so-called revelations, the pseudo-revelations, they have overly covered it, 24/7, CNN, NBC. I mean, when you see places like Washington Post, LA Times, NBC, CNN, even that comedian guy, whatever, I don't have TV, all of those guys are covering it 24/7. You know that it's the establishment is giving you. You see, we can't have it both ways, Peter. We cannot say that the media blacks out the truth, which they do. They black out and they completely censure real whistleblowers, which they do, okay? And then come and say, and media is covering all the stuff, even though this is revelation.
Well,
so
to respond to the point, here's what I think the critical difference is. If Greenwald confirms through Snowden documents what Russ Tice told us, that Dianne Feinstein and Barack Obama and the members of the Supreme Court were wiretapped, it comes back to what we discussed earlier about Vietnam. Their self-interest will motivate them to action where the purported public interest has not.
Okay, well, how about this? I know this is not a gambling site, okay? But I'm willing to go ahead and bet, and we can put our bet here. It is not going to be Feinstein. It's going to be some people that they would like to see go because the election season is coming. And I will wage my bet this way. Nothing will even come out of it, even if they were to put three, four, or five names. Come on, what is Merck Merkel doing with finding out that Obama and NSA, they are spying on them? This has made Americans far more desensitized and far more open to be propagandized. I mean, that's the best word I can use. A lot of people are making me, I mean, can you imagine if you have real whistleblower, a real story, a real revelation that you're getting Hollywood, Sony Pictures, the same guys who are making all the CIA movies and the top publishers and all the mainstream media that you and I have spent so many years criticizing, Peter. And a guy who's sitting in Russia, he's being interviewed by Brian Williams, whatever is his name, is NBC guy, and he's being shown live in BBC or whatever in UK. I mean, this is, for me, actually, it is so fake, and it's so obviously fake that I can't believe people are falling for it. It's because so obvious, but maybe people want to fall for it. And this was addressed through this piece of people want to see some heroes, and people want to see some of these things, the way the scenario has been written. None of these people are legit. Everything is scripted, a complete scenario. Up until 6-7 months ago, I was putting it, the doubt thing, possibly it is. I can tell you with 100% certainty, as a whistleblower, from my perspective, from what I see, from what I've analyzed, this is completely scripted. There is not even 0.1% chance that anything about this is real. I mean, this is one of the most successful PSYOPs I have seen. When the PSYOP was written so awfully bad, but people have become so dumbified that it's even the dumb sci-fi works on them. I mean, PSYOP works on them. I don't know what to say on that. But on that same note, I agree with Peter that we do need to have more facts. That I agree. What I was saying with the majority saying we need more documents, we need more revelations, whenever it comes, I mean, it has come to a point that I want something bigger. And maybe the next one is going to be bigger. The next one, this next Snowden, is going to actually fly a Gulfstream, and he's going to have this fantastical escape out of the Langley's, you know, landing, whatever area they have, or a helicopter. It's going to be hijacked. You know, there's going to be some Black Ops people going after him. But it's going to be more fantastical because it takes that. Because they made it, the key point, and this is one of the things that Guillermo brought up, they made it entertaining because they are working for the market. And they said, this is what America wants. Let's have a nice PSYOP and make it highly entertaining, beginning to end. Everyone in this, every actor, they are... And including the naive, even activists who have fallen for it, the complete made up Hollywood, and most likely came out of Hollywood. They worked together with the CIA, but there is not a single shred of truth in there. And I believe even the whistleblowers who are now standing up and talking for Snowden, it's about maybe a few years. Give it time. As like Osama bin Laden things, the story is going to change. More things is going to be revealed. They're going to regret because they are losing their credibility. And I have given them the warning. I said, just wait. A few years from now, you're going to regret doing this, because then I'm going to hold you accountable, every one of you, because I'm not going to say, hey, they were naive. They fell for it. They were warned. I have given them all the indications are before them, and they are really putting their own credibility in line, including Russ Dice, unfortunately, someone I really like, I'm protective of, but he's falling for it. And it's sad. It's really sad to see it. And it's been fun for everyone, Congress, CIA, courts, everyone. Even Snowden's father is having fun. I mean, look at all the actors involved, Bruce Fine, Sony Picture, come on. I mean,
bigger. It's been highly entertaining, and it's no surprise that it's turned into a Hollywood production, for sure.
The key thing is, though, Guillermo, is more people are joining this club. The people who have been saying this doesn't seem right, including Chris Floyd. He has written 3-4 very good articles, and Chris Floyd has been known to be on the left, as far as I know. He has written on that. As you know, Pando has written on that. More, and even on the Alex Jones side, people are coming and saying, wait a second, there is something really fishy going on here. And they have been actually supporting and cheering up for the guy. But you see more and more and more people coming this way because, I mean, this is so phony. It couldn't be any phonier. And as far as the the what we do, Yerma, as you said, we do what we do with each one of us with our own style. But there are things, would it be radical to say, thou shalt not kill? I don't care which religion is saying it. I don't know which philosophy is saying it. You don't ever make that a mild thing and put some sort of condition. You don't kill a lot. You know, you don't kill too many babies. They just say, thou shalt not kill. Now, if that makes it radical, I really like that kind of radicalism. In our country, murder is a crime. And when it goes to court, it's not only the murderer, but also that gets to be punished, but also people who are accessory to crime, okay? Our nation is committing, our government, our military is committing murders, okay? They're killing babies, they're killing women, children. They are killing, they are racking home, they are committing murders. And we have been accessory to that murder. It makes it radical? Fine, I am not going to make it less radical. This is not something that I'm gonna say, it would be good if we were to kill a little bit less people, guys. You know, just kill 5 kids instead of killing 500. Okay, that is not gonna make it better. So as far as that kind of radicalism, man, I'm gonna hopefully give more. And I think to a certain degree, if that is radicalism, it's really good to be idealistic and radicals. And I have seen some comments on the website, on our roundtable on anarchism and other points of views. People are saying, these are starry-eyed idealists. The young, they're operating out of their bedrooms, starry-eyed, naive bunch of people, idealists. And usually they use this idealist as an insult. I think it's a beautiful thing to be an idealist. My father said that until the day he died, despite the fact that he was tortured, despite the fact that he went through a lot of hell. He always said, I love it. There is nothing insulting about idealism. And some people said it's childish. He said, I would love to keep this child alive for as long as you live. And the moment that child inside of me dies, and that is the idealism, I hope I will die that day. And I would love to keep up, and I'm going to do my best to remain radical idealist. And that's for me and for our partners. You all have your own style. But please do not expect anything different. I respect, I love Gandhi, was a great guy, and all Dalai Lama and all the stuff, but I'm not going to chant and I'm not going to do Kumbaya. I listen to Peter, Paul, Mary. I love it. That's good. That's not my style. During my whistleblowing years, the first 3 years, I was told by POGO and GAP, those so-called whistleblowers organization, you whistleblowers, instead of taking it into your own hands and doing this activism, why don't you set up a comfort group, okay? Solidarity, because you have gone through a lot of psychological trauma and your spouses have gone through that. You have a support network and do Kumbaya and yoga and more Kumbaya, and let us take care of this stuff with activism, with Congress and everything, and not be like Sibel wants you to be like Genghis Khan and say, yeehaw, let's go there and we'll take it. We are whistleblowers. We're going to go and get it done ourselves. They wanted us to do Kumbaya. Kumbaya is a good thing. Please keep it up, but you also need to stand up and take action and do things. And that's one of the things that we are trying to do the most here at Boiling Frogs Post. Peter?
Well, I guess you're not going to be posting any recipes for gluten-free muffins at boilingfrogspost.com. Our thanks to our panelists, Guillermo Jimenez, James Corbett, Sibel Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for joining us today for the Boiling Frogs Post Roundtable.